This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams, sitting in for Carol Castiel. On this edition of the program, we examine al-Shabaab's recent massacre at Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in the deaths of 148 people. We're also going to mark the one-year anniversary of the abduction of 276 Nigerian schoolgirls by Boko Haram. Well, joining me to discuss the massacre in Kenya and the abduction in Nigeria are J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Lauren Plock Blanchard, Specialist in African Affairs at the Congressional Research Service. Both guests join me at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington, and welcome to you both.
Thank you,
Sarah.
Well, beginning with you, first of all, Mr. Pham, did the attack at Garissa, does this mark a new phase for the Somalia-based group al-Shabaab?
Well, it marks a different phase, but one which it has been evolving into. If we take as an arbitrary starting point September 2012, when the current Somali government was instituted in Mogadishu, from there until the following year, September 2013, when the infamous attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi occurred, Shabaab actually launched 42 different attacks inside Kenya. Most had relatively few casualties, so went unremarked in the international press. And then the year between a half between Westgate and now, there have been a further 63 attacks by Shabaab in Kenya, with much higher fatalities, over 400 during that period. So it's been a steady increasing tempo, but the sheer horror of Kenya's largest terrorist attack since the embassy bombings almost 20 years ago certainly brought this to our attention on the global stage.
Yeah, looking at that, Ms. Blanchard, as Mr. Pham said, this was the worst attack since the 1998 attack on Kenyan soil at the U.S. embassy. And then if you do look at the Westgate Mall, does this suggest that these militants, I mean, further attacks must, seems like very likely, would be, you know, in the planning stages?
That seems to be what both the Kenyan government and the international community, particularly those with embassy representation in Kenya, are very concerned about. You know, Nairobi, Kenya's capital, is an international hub for the region and really for the continent. It is home to one of four UN headquarters worldwide. Many foreign governments have, you know, if they have minimal representation on the continent, they have an embassy in Kenya. You have major foreign companies represented in the city. So there are a lot of sort of very prominent international targets. Kenya is a popular tourist destination, although its tourism industry has really been hit hard by these attacks. And as Peter outlined, Kenya has suffered sort of a real increase in extremist attacks, although the country is no stranger to extremism. But the average victim of these attacks has been your average Kenyan citizen, and they are really sort of feeling the threat increasing.
Mr. Pham, is it known whether there were any warnings to this attack in Garissa?
The specific target, Garissa University College, I'm not sure that there was any specific warning that that was the target, but that that area of northeastern Kenya near the Somali border was going to, that some attack was in the planning stages and about to be implemented was certainly well known. Embassies, a number of foreign embassies in Nairobi issued warnings to their citizens to stay out of that area. So there was certainly warning that there should have precipitated heightened security. And regrettably, at Garissa University College, from reports, there were only two security guards on duty at the time the attack occurred. So it doesn't appear as if security was heightened there. And unfortunately, that made it all the more easy for the terrorists to act.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Blanchard, looking at the victims, or most of the victims, you know, university students, young, their lives ahead of them, it's just such a tragedy. It makes, again, wonder whether these militants sort of looked at them as a, you know, as a, to get the maximum amount of impact.
Yeah, I think, you know, in hindsight, the university was a somewhat obvious potential target for al-Shabaab. It had just opened in 2013 and was drawing students from across the country, not only from the predominantly Muslim northeast, but also from Christian areas and other ethnic groups around the country. This was the first university in the northeast and really a point of pride for the region and for the government that had had sort of been accused of marginalizing the Northeast. And, you know, in hindsight, again, as Peter points out, it doesn't appear that necessarily there was enough security given the range of security threats that were being discussed prior to the attack. You know, we've seen a real increase in al-Shabaab attacks in Northeast and the coastal region broadly. You know, hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah. And then the fact that apparently as the attack continued, the students apparently were segregated by or questioned about their religion. And of course, those who were Christian were victimized.
Yeah. And this was something that we've seen in a number of al-Shabaab attacks recently. In November and December of last year, a number of pretty brutal attacks up in Mandera, a town in northeastern Kenya, where they were segregating Christians. The Mpeketoni attacks, which is a settlement near Lamu on the coast of Kenya near the Somali border. Last summer, we also saw the targeting of Christians, but also potentially based on ethnicity, being from Central Province, which is the area, the heartland of the president, President Kenyatta's ethnic community. And that community is seen to some extent to have settled in areas beyond their home area and has generated some resentment, particularly on the coast. And I think there is a speculation that al-Shabaab is trying to play on some of the communal grievances that already exist and foment divisions that are already there in some of these communities.
Mr. Fahm, al-Shabaab announced soon after, I think actually that day or the day after the Garissa attack, that Kenyan cities will run red with blood. Is it known what the Kenyan officials are doing to try to improve security in the country?
Well, unfortunately, they've taken some measures, but certainly not nowhere near sufficient. In the wake of the September 2013 Westgate Mall attack, Kenyan police actually recruited some 10,000 new police officers, personnel. But we've since learned that the recruiting process was vitiated by corruption. And in fact, that's a major issue. Kenya, for example, has a very relatively well-trained commando unit within the police force, the General Services Unit, that should have been on the scene. What happened? Well, as we now find out, the police air chief's family was using the Cessna plane that should have taken the unit to Garissa to go on vacation. And so the attack began at 7:30 in the morning. The plane didn't return with the vacationing family, who had the insensitivity to put up their photos sitting on the plane on Instagram, until 11:30, didn't take off again until 12:30, didn't arrive in Garissa till just shy of 2 p.m. And of course, the commandos didn't swing into action until about 5 p.m. There were reporters in Nairobi who, when they first heard reports of the attack, got in their cars and drove to Garissa and made it there before the commandos. So you can see the challenges that lie ahead to build up the security that Kenya needs to confront this growing threat.
Yes, I read that there was a lot of criticism about that at the time. But I've also read that compared to the Westgate Mall, which I think that happened over 4 days, they did get there within a day. But of course, a huge amount of people were killed.
Yes, and I think there's only one incident going. Imagine if Shabaab adopts the classic tactic of many terrorist groups of simultaneous attacks in two different locations. There are incredible challenges ahead. Shabaab has been set back militarily in the last several years by the combined efforts of the African Union Force in Somalia, neighboring countries, and the support of the international community. But I think we lull ourselves into a false sense of security. But I think that military defeats on the battlefield equate with the elimination of Shabaab as a threat. The threat has simply morphed, it's transformed, but it remains very much a real threat.
And Ms. Blanchard, apparently only 4 attackers took part in this attack, and thinking of just a few people, and yet so many people died.
And that was what we saw in the Westgate attacks. I mean, you had a small number of attackers, presumably less than 10, although I think we still don't really have all of the details on that attack. And they were able to hold really sort of an entire mall hostage for days. I think another interesting thing that seems to be coming out in some of the press reporting recently is the fact that the identity of these 4 attackers who were killed at the end of the attack, they may all be Kenyan nationals. And I think this is interesting to look at in terms of the government's response so far, which has been a bit confusing, I think, looking at it from the outside. The Kenyan government, in days after the attack, announced that it was going to close Dadaab refugee camp. This is Africa's largest refugee camp. You know, these people have been here for 20 years, some of them in Dadaab, some of them in Nairobi. Early last year, Kenya really came under criticism from the international community, from human rights advocates, for the mass roundup of Somalis in the country. They rounded up more than 4,000 people and tried to forcibly relocate many of them to Dadaab refugee camp, several hundred of them back to Somalia. And I think these roundups are seen in the context of what Somali Kenyans and the Muslim community in Kenya more broadly see as really discrimination, unjust discrimination under the guise of counterterrorism efforts. So I think, you know, we don't know all of the details, and the investigation is still ongoing on who these attackers were. But if they were Kenyan rather than Somali, then it begs the question of why all of the focus on building a wall on the border of Kenya and Somalia and sending all of the Somali refugees home, many of whom have been victims of al-Shabaab themselves.
Yeah, well, certainly, Mr. Pham, I mean, when you look at that very troubled border into Somalia and, you know, the concerns where Kenya is, it's sort of how should it deal with the situation?
Well, I think several things. And Lauren is quite correct that the Kenyan government is trying to paint an entire community, an entire segment of the population with very broad strokes. And what's really needed is an increase in policing capacity and intelligence capacity. There's been a lot of attention by the international community on the military challenges of Shabaab. And by and large, after rather slow and not always successful start, the military campaign against Shabaab inside Somalia has been successful. But the challenge has morphed. Now we have to deal with challenges in Kenya and perhaps even in other states in the region. And so that requires policing, a different set of skills, different type of assistance. And the best way to do policing is with the support of local communities, being parts of those communities rather than trying to blame the communities or stigmatize the communities.
Do you think, in your opinion, is the Kenyan government up to doing that?
Well, it needs to be, or else next time it's not just going to be 147 students slaughtered early in the morning on a Thursday morning. It could be something larger. It's going to be ongoing. And for a country that's so heavily dependent upon tourism, this is devastating. And the northern part of Kenya has also received the largest infrastructure development in the country, in fact, East Africa's history, with this corridor that will bring development, infrastructure, and transport to that north. And that's not going to happen. Investors aren't going to come to that if this is the news cycle, the news story that they're going to be hearing all the time.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Lauren Plott Blanchard, Specialist in African Affairs at the Congressional Research Service. We're talking about al-Shabaab and Boko Haram. I'm Sarah Williams, sitting in for Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow Carol on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like and connect with us on Facebook. Ms. Blanchard, how does this recent violence in Kenya play into Kenyan politics? Because I know there are a number of concerns about domestic corruption.
It's a pretty complicated story. You know, Kenya is on a path of political reforms that they adopted under the new 2010 constitution. And it was a very progressive constitution. It established a Bill of Rights and set in motion really a number of pretty critical political reforms that opposition and civil society groups had been advocating for over a decade since President Daniel Arap Moi in the late 90s. And so I think in many ways they're grappling with how to deal with these pressures and at the same time really advance an economic growth agenda that President Kenyatta and his vice president William Ruto have been trying to push. You know, Kenya is one of the world's fastest growing economies. They revised their GDP statistical base last year and they are now considered almost a middle income country. But you still have 4 out of 10 Kenyans sort of living in absolute poverty. You still have those underlying ethnic grievances and community grievances that relayed the violence that followed the 2007 elections. And I think those grievances have not gone away and have not been addressed. There are a lot of outstanding concerns about land reform that the government has been a bit slow to address, and they're delicate and tricky issues. The government has not been seen to be as tough until recently, maybe, on corruption as I think most people would like to see. There is an accountability problem. And recent efforts by the president to roll out a new anti-corruption agenda are portrayed by some in the opposition and even within his own Jubilee ruling coalition as partisan and politically motivated. So I think the government has a lot of challenges. And as Peter described, really sort of tackling these various security threats that they're facing, not just the terrorism problem, but also violent gang activity and criminality, poaching and wildlife trafficking, drug trafficking, and community violence that is quite extreme and has killed hundreds in the last few years. These are challenges that they don't currently have all of the tools to deal with. I think the question in terms of police reform and accountability is, are they doing enough to respond to the concerns raised after Westgate, after the Mpeketoni attacks, sort of how do they get beyond being constantly reactive to these attacks and be able to sort of get out in front and building links with communities rather than alienating people in the communities where they need to be able to get more information and cooperation.
Well, we are also marking the one-year anniversary of the abduction of more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls from Chibok in the northeastern part of the country. And when it occurred, there was this massive campaign on Twitter called, you know, Bring Back Our Girls. Mr. Pham, what happened to that? There was so much, you know, international attention given and so much concern. It was a horrible story, of course, but then it sort of seems to just sort of, you don't hear much about it anymore.
Well, it's unfortunate that the tragedy of the kidnapping of the schoolgirls from Chibok, like so many other tragedies in Africa, turns into a fad. It's very easy for celebrities and others to make themselves appear relevant and concerned, and they pick it up for a day or two or a week, and then they move on to other things. And the underlying, for a moment, some attention is focused, and for that we're grateful, but then they move on and the challenges remain. In fact, the kidnapping of the schoolgirls, tragic in and of itself, was, as human rights groups have reported, part and parcel of an overall terror strategy of Boko Haram. Estimates are last year Boko Haram kidnapped over 2,000 women and girls from other communities. In fact, continues to do so to this day. Boko Haram-related violence just in 2014 alone cost more than 10,000 Nigerians their lives. Over 1.5 million people were displaced from their homes. So it was a tremendous challenge. And then within that, all that humanitarian suffering, there was the military threat of Boko Haram. During the course of the second half of 2014, the group seized territory with increasing impunity to the point where it controlled an area as large as Belgium and Luxembourg put together in northeastern Nigeria. And it's only been literally in the last several weeks, 2 months, where a combined effort of Nigerian military, reportedly aided by foreign military contractors, as well as neighboring military forces from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, have managed to roll back Boko Haram, take back territory from the group. But the group still remains very much a terrorist threat to the region, and perhaps even more so now that it's pledged allegiance to the so-called Islamic State.
Mm. Just following up on that, what is known about the connections between Boko Haram, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and even Al-Shabaab?
I think the pledge of allegiance to the Islamic State came at a moment of weakness for both of them. Boko Haram was under military assault by Nigeria and its neighbors. Islamic State was suffering reverses at the hands of the Kurdish militias, the Iraqi military, and Shiite militias in Iraq. So they both kind of needed a fillip of some kinds of Boko. Now, what didn't come out in a vacuum, Boko Haram and the Islamic State have been trading, if you will, virtual compliments in the extremist blogosphere for some time and messages back and forth. But they both needed a propaganda coup, and this provided it. That being said, that doesn't mean that it's totally empty of substance. It's very telling that the most recent edition of Dabiq, which is the Islamic State's English magazine, contained an entire article on Boko Haram's Pledge of Allegiance, in which the spokesman for the so-called Khalif of the Islamic State said that those fighters who can't make it to the territory of the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant should consider going to Nigeria and joining with Boko Haram in the struggle there. So it's an incitement. Whether anyone answers that call, we don't know yet, but in all probability, at least some people are going to try it. So there is a risk of an internationalization of what had been largely a Nigeria-focused insurgency in one specific region of Nigeria.
Sounds very, very, very frightening. Ms. Blanchard, is it known how the incoming president, Muhammadu Buhari, is going to be handling this?
Well, this is the big question. He has made a number of statements that suggest that this is a top priority for him. It was a major campaign agenda for President-elect Buhari and his party, the All Progressives Congress. They really came in on an agenda of pushing for change and reform. The big criticism, I think, that the Bring Back Our Girls campaign helped to stoke was that the President Jonathan's administration had not been doing enough to counter the group. And I think what is actually really important and interesting to look at is how the Bring Back Our Girls campaign sort of changed attitudes and changed the way that people in southern Nigeria viewed the insurgency and the Boko Haram attacks. I think many of them had seen the threat as sort of far removed from them. And I think it helped sort of to humanize the victims of Boko Haram and sort of brought about a broader national concern about the group's trajectory. And, you know, I think to go back to Peter's point about sort of Boko Haram ISIS allegiances, we saw some changes in the way Boko Haram was behaving last year. Prior to the summer of last year, they hadn't been taking and seizing territory. They'd been primarily focused on guerrilla-style terrorist attacks. And starting in July and August, they, like the Islamic State, started to take territory with the goal of supposedly creating an Islamic State in Nigeria. And you know, I think for ISIS, the most recent issue of their magazine, Dabiq, as Peter mentioned, has on the cover of it, Sharia will rule Africa. This is, to them, the new frontier. And there are, obviously, theoretically, a lot of recruits for them to focus on to build their core fighting base. So in terms of how President-elect Buhari will deal with this, he's got a tough challenge ahead. One of the major criticisms of the response so far by the Nigerians is that there is a lot of corruption at the top of the security forces, and that they haven't been prioritizing the right equipment and protective gear for troops on the front lines, that the troops on the front lines don't have gas for their vehicles or bullets for their guns. So this is something that may not be quick to shift, but it seems that it's going to be a top priority for him. I think he has been interestingly honest in terms of managing expectations about the Chibok girls in particular, and saying that he doesn't have any indication that the Nigerian government actually knows where they are. Whether they're still alive. There are some reports that suggest that some groups of them may have been killed in some of the recent fights between Boko Haram and regional security forces to take back territory from Boko Haram. So I think he's trying to manage expectations that he doesn't come in on May 30th and sort of be instantly responsible for finding the girls and returning them safely to their families.
Yes, and Mr. Fama, I was just thinking as Ms. Blanchard was speaking about that there's is some horrible, haunting similarities to the attack in Garissa, attacking, you know, going after an educational setting, students, young people, you know, one sudden. It's just, it's frightening to think that this, you know, this is sort of a terror strategy now.
Well, terrorists seek, first and foremost, to call attention to themselves. And it's a race to the bottom. The more horrific, the more brutal their acts, the more attention they will get, the more news coverage we give them, so that raises their profile among other groups. We have to acknowledge that that's probably part and parcel of the strategic thinking of Shabab. They had once controlled 2/3 or more of Somalia, were governing, were seen as puissant, and all of a sudden they'd fallen far behind the Islamic State, even Boko Haram, and this put them back in the headlines. So it's an attention grabber. And unfortunately, horror, gore cells and terrorist groups will seek that because it not only raises their profile, but raising their profile brings in recruits and it brings in potentially funding, and that's what they're seeking.
Mm-hmm. I guess also you thinking about recruitment, there must be, I guess, continuing campaigns in both Kenya and also Nigeria to replenish the groups of these militants. And it's sort of like, who do they look for? Disgruntled youths or?
You know, I think that is a quick assumption. I think we're still learning how they're recruiting, and I think the recruiting methods are changing. I've been quite concerned about the recruitment trends in Kenya. I think we may be seeing sort of a decrease in recruitment in Somalia, where some studies suggest that recruitment was to some extent driven by economic circumstance and by clan affiliation. And as Al-Shabaab has lost territory, they may be losing the ability to recruit in those areas. But in Kenya, we are seeing some signs that ideology is really driving the recruitment there, and that Al-Shabaab is very savvy in its propaganda tools, its media campaigns, videos, use of social media, trying to play on existing communal grievances and trying to really fuel rifts between communities, particularly sort of most broadly the Christian Muslim population. Populations in Kenya, but also smaller communal tensions among ethnic groups and communities in certain parts of the country. So I think this is really worrying. It's something that the government has to get in front of and figure out how to head off without actually sort of further fueling the problem.
Mm-hmm. And really, when you look at something back in 2013, the attack of the Westgate Mall, I remember when I heard about that, thinking that what a terrible thing, and that could be exported to, say, other countries.
And that's certainly something. We don't want to overhype and give them the benefit of that extra bit of publicity. On the other hand, we shouldn't also rest on our laurel. One of the reasons Shabaab is a particularly pernicious group is, unlike other groups abroad who may occasionally attract the so-called lone wolf attack or the isolated person who radicalizes through a virtual connection and then may travel for training or come back, Shabaab has, over the years, have a very small, representing an infinitesimally small minority, but it's still a network within the United States of people who have sent fighters or become fighters themselves with Shabaab in Somalia, lent material assistance by facilitating people to go there or sending money. And there have been prosecutions brought successfully by the Department of Justice in both the Bush and Obama administrations for cyberconduct. So there is a network, however fragile, however small, it's there. We're sitting in Washington, D.C., Sarah. Just a few months ago, the raised up to the FBI 10 Most Wanted was a former taxi cab driver in Northern Virginia who had gone to join Shabaab. He was ultimately arrested by Somali authorities and will presumably be sent back at some point for trial here. But that shows a reach back into our countries, the United States, and certainly also into Europe, Northern Europe in particular, that other groups don't have as well developed as Shabaab.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. And I would think also dealing, say, looking at Europe, which is a lot closer to some of these areas, both in the African continent, about concerns about recruitment and people visiting and taking that back to, say, European communities.
I think it's something that the European officials have been looking at for quite a while. U.S. and European law enforcement and U.K. law enforcement agencies have been sharing sort of tactics and strategies for how to track these movements, sort of money flows. One of the big concerns of advocacy groups and humanitarian organizations is that Western sanctions related to terrorism financing don't inadvertently affect sort of the broader Somali population. There's a lot of concern about the shutting of bank accounts of Somali remittance companies, both in Europe and the United States, and now most recently in Kenya. And these obviously provide a vital lifeline to Somalia, where they don't have a formal banking system right now. So I think, the challenge for the United States and European governments and for the Kenyan government is how to balance that response and not affect the broader community.
Well, a lot of challenges certainly to be confronted. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Lauren Plock-Blanchard, Specialist in African Affairs at the Congressional Research Service, and J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And Encounter was produced here in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests, and our engineer was Chen Wang. I'm Sarah Williams, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.